This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, State Comptroller Kevin Lembo will tell us about his new plan for Connecticut's rainy day fund. And fiscally, it does seem to be a bit of a rainy day. But at first, the average American doesn't realize the laws written by lobbyists. As a matter of fact, here's Eric Schmidt, the former Google CEO, talking in a 2010 interview with The Atlantic.
The average American doesn't realize how much the laws are written by lobbyists. And that is, and I'm not trying to offend anyone who might be of that like here, and it's shocking now, having spent a fair amount of time inside the system, how the system actually works.
How the system actually works is something that a lot of us don't understand, but every year for-profit corporations spend billions on reported lobbying expenditures. It's a big investment that's placed American business among the most powerful forces in Washington and in state houses like the one in Hartford. But just how do corporations lobby and why? I assume it works pretty well. Today, lobbyists and lobbying experts weigh in on the growth of corporate lobbying in America. And you can join the conversation 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. is Lee Drutman, senior fellow at New America, author of The Business of America is Lobbying, How Corporations Became Politicized and Politics Became More Corporate. Lee, welcome to the program.
It's a thrill to be with you.
Well, let's start a little bit with the history. A lot of us think that the way we have lobbying in Washington and Hartford and other state capitals, it's always been like this. But you say it hasn't. Maybe you can take us back to, say, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. What was lobbying like back then?
Well, prior to the 1970s, very few corporations had their own lobbyists in Washington and many of the state capitals. There were trade associations, certainly, but they weren't nearly as active and certainly not nearly as proactive as they are now. I mean, lobbying used to be sparse and defensive, and it's become ubiquitous, preemptive, proactive.
When you say proactive, give me some examples of proactivity, how that has changed from, say, the early days.
Well, it used to be that the attitude that corporations had was keep government out of our business. And over the years, that's changed. As one lobbyist said it, who I interviewed, described it, it's gone from leave us alone to let's work on this together. It's gone to seeing how we can make government our partners. And that's a big change.
It is a big change, and it's a big change that interestingly coincided with, you know, the Reagan era in the 1980s. I mean, Ronald Reagan famously didn't really want to have a government the size of the government that we had at the time, but we had a whole business climate that was saying, let's work with government to get stuff done. Interesting coalition there, isn't it?
Well, certainly when Reagan came to office, it was this idea that government had gotten too big, and the idea was to get government out of the way. And in fact, the business community had come together in the 70s to respond to a growing regulatory state and a growing government that they felt really threatened the free enterprise system. So Reagan was really the apotheosis of that movement. But consequence of that is, as government has shrunk, the responsibilities of government have not shrunk, and the complexity of policy has not shrunk. So you have this increasing gap between what we expect out of government and what we give government the resources to do. And into that gap have stepped lobbyists, most of them corporate, to, as the opening quote that you started the program with tells us, that corporations and their lobbyists are now writing the laws.
Give us some examples of that, of corporations writing the laws, because we hear about examples of this, but when you actually see it in action, it is fairly startling that indeed it's not the people that we elect to Congress all the time. It's not the staff members working hard and in Washington. It's lobbyists working on these bills.
Well, the staff members are working hard, but they're stretched incredibly thin. They're covering dozens of issues in limited time. They're not experts. They tend to be young, ambitious people who just don't have the deep expertise and legal knowledge to write these bills. So, for example, there's a well-known case at the previous Congress where Citigroup wrote a provision to repeal a portion of the Dodd-Frank bill. That provision passed the House, then later got included in the Cromnibus bill, and And it was only because of investigative reporting that we were able to piece together that the language that Citigroup had submitted was pretty much the language that was in the bill. But this happens all the time. It's just we don't often see that happening because we don't know what lobbyists are submitting to Congress.
It's not just the language that is being put into bills that maybe is coming directly from corporate lobbyists. It's also, as you mentioned earlier, the complexity of policy. We often complain about the 1,000-page bill that no one has time to read, but the complexity in part is there because, well, lobbyists like it that way.
Well, certainly it does help lobbyists in their interests, right? I mean, we have a tax code, for example, this is the most glaring example of it, that is 3.8 million words long. It's about 6.5 times the length of War and Peace, by the way. And that tax code is a product of thousands. In fact, between 1986, when the tax code was reformed, and 2005, there were 15,000 affirmative changes to the tax code, most of them put in place by lobbyists. The more complex, the harder it is for the public to understand, the harder to see where the money is going, and the harder it is for anybody else but the specialized lobbyists to understand that particular piece of the law. And that empowers them both with their clients and with Congress.
How much money are we talking about? If we say billions spent in lobbying expenditures in Washington each year, probably untold billions spent in state houses around the country, do we have a real grasp on how much money is in lobbying, Lee?
Well, we can only look at reported lobbying. It's about $3.2 billion a year. About $2.6 billion of that is corporate lobbying, so about 80%. Now, because a lot of what I would consider to be lobbying activity, probably most people would consider, is not actually reported, a good estimate is to actually double that. There are a lot of folks like Tom Daschle being a well-known example who decide that they don't want to register because of all the burdens that places on them, and they don't want to be called lobbyists because we've demonized lobbyists as a class of people. So they don't register all the activity they do, the strategic consulting, the occasional phone calls, the planning, all the grassroots, all the media strategies, none of that, all the coalition building, none of that gets reported. If you were to report that, I think you'd have a total closer to $5 or $6 billion a year in Washington, and you know, probably as at the states, more than that combined.
We're talking with Lee Drutman, whose book is The Business of America is Lobbying, How Corporations Became Politicized and Politics Became More Corporate. You can join us at 860-275-7266. Before we bring in our next guest, who is a lobbyist who works here in Connecticut, I'll ask you, Lee, you mentioned, you know, whether it's Tom Daschle or somebody else not wanting to be registered as a lobbyist in part because the profession itself has been demonized. I mean, do you think that's right? I mean, do you think that whether it's your book or a lot of the way we think about that job, that we have unfairly in some ways demonized this entire sector of work? Because there's probably an awful lot of good stuff that gets done in Washington and elsewhere.
I think we have demonized it, and I think that's been a real mistake. Look, lobbying is essential to our democracy. Special interests are essential to our democracy. That's politics. Different people have different interests, and they want to go have those voices represented in Washington. The problem is when you have one side that has all the resources and hires all the lobbyists, which happens to be increasingly the corporate side, and you have another side, which is what you might expect to be countervailing forces like public interest and unions who just don't have the resources. I've tallied up the number. For every $1 that public interest groups and unions combined spend on lobbying, businesses spend $34. And that ratio has been increasing. In 1998, it was 22 to 1. So, yes, special interests are part of politics. Lobbying is part of politics. But that glaring, stark imbalance doesn't need to be part of politics.
Lee Drutman, stand by. I want to bring into the conversation Chris Vandehoof, who's director of government relations at Ticket Network now, but he's held many jobs inside this business and out, working in politics, working in business. And I appreciate you coming in, Chris. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
Chris, what's the job? Tell us what lobbyists do.
I'm not sure we have enough time for that, but but you know, we spend our time becoming when I was a contract lobbyist and had many clients working in the state house. I spent the majority of my time researching numerous issues. Contract lobbyists get to know a little bit about a lot. Now I'm an in-house lobbyist with a corporation like Lee is talking about, and it's my job now to know a lot about something specific so that when I do meet with legislators, whether that's in Hartford or another state or in Washington, D.C., I'm the expert on whatever it is that that I'm representing. In this case, it happens to be the ticket industry, but it can be anything, just like you referenced the Citigroup guys.
And maybe we'll get back to this role as a contract lobbyist where you are maybe working at a number of different fields and maybe sometimes even across purposes, which is an interesting part of that job. But when you're working for a specific company, tell me about the type of relationship you're trying to build, the type of information you're trying to get to, whether it's staffers or individual lawmakers, about the business that you work for.
Sure. Just yesterday, I had three, four meetings up in Boston to discuss a bill that's bouncing around up there. And what my goal is coming out of these meetings is to show the legislator, in the cases where we're meeting with the legislator, or show staff when we're meeting with upper level staff, that we're an expert on the industry. We understand that our opposition is going to meet with them as well and encourage them to broaden their knowledge on the issue and encourage them to have those discussions. But when they have questions as bills move through the process, we want them to be able to reach out to us for, hey, this bill does X or this bill does Y. What do you think about it? And assuming that they're going to call the opposition for the same information.
Assuming they're going to call the opposition, I think part of the point that Lee makes is the opposition might not be there. There may just only be the corporate side.
That's absolutely right. You know, and I think Lee's, you know, I've not read Lee's book, but doing some research on some smart writing, he did it for the Times and the Post and the Atlantic, is I think Lee's point is right, is that, you know, taking care of staff and investing more money in Congress and in state legislatures coast to coast makes a lot of sense. You know, we're only as good as the people that we can bring in. And so to the extent that we can make these professional jobs with a professional salary and benefits and all the things that come with working in the private sector, I think the talent level certainly increases.
I think, Lee, a very proactive piece of what you have written about that Chris brings up is the sense that in many ways, lobbying firms and lobbyists for corporations, they fill a vacuum that is there because in Washington specifically and also here in Hartford, lawmakers are relying on very talented but very low-paid staff members to make an awful lot of decisions. And maybe there should be, Lee, a change there, professionalizing, making this a more serious job for people so that lobbyists don't have to step in and do some of this work.
I think that's exactly right. You know, sarcastic observers say we have the best Congress that money can buy. Actually, I think it's the opposite. We've been doing Congress and many state legislatures as well on the cheap for a long time. And you know what? We get what we pay for. We can bring in smart young people, but they burn out quickly as soon as they get expertise and really understand the process as well as the policy. They often have to leave because they're not paid well enough. The jobs are stressful, long. They burn out. They want to spend time with their families. And we need to make it so that Congress, as well as many state houses, are places where people can build a career, can develop real expertise, so that they don't have to rely on lobbyists always to explain the policy entirely to them. I mean, lobbyists do play an important role, and I think anybody who has been in Congress appreciates that lobbyists do bring perspectives that you might not have otherwise. But you need to understand something about the issues that you're working on in order to know when somebody's trying to give you BS and when they're not.
And that's one of the questions. Obviously, the lawmaker, the staff, Chris, needs to know a little bit about him or herself, what they think good policy is, and also needs to know an awful lot about it. I think about this, and I meet with politicians all the time. I can't imagine keeping this many things in my head that may be coming across my desk. I can see how a lobbyist, someone very smart on a very specific issue, can sit down, educate them, and you can come out of it saying, well, I don't have a whole lot of time to read on everything. This guy Chris makes a pretty good point.
Yeah, no, and listen, legislators certainly can't be expected to read every word of every bill that gets proposed. You know, at the state level here in Connecticut, in a long session, there could be between 2,000 and 3,000 proposals that are before the legislature. Certainly not all of those make it through the process, but you can't expect a person in a part-time legislature to sit down and read through 3,000 pieces of legislation. And so that is where lobbyists come in. And you know, one of the key things, if you're going to be successful in the business of lobbying the legislature or in Congress, it's that your word is everything. You simply cannot be dishonest. You can't be misleading. And while there's certainly that that point of view out there that that's how the business works. It is not accurate. If you're going to do this job and do it well, you have to be bluntly honest, even when it's not necessarily the argument you're looking to make, if they ask the questions to pull that out.
We're going to be talking with a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. in a couple of minutes, and I know you've worked in Washington and in Hartford, but just maybe, Chris, you can give us an example of how the money works as best you can. I mean, if you think about a company wanting to get something done, something that might make millions of dollars for them over the course of 10 years, how much money is a good investment in lobbying on a specific bill that might have that outcome later? Are we talking about 0.1%, or are we talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars? I mean, give us some sort of a range, an example here.
I'm not sure that there is a range. I think it sort of depends on one, where you are, what state you're in. If this is a state issue, if it's a federal issue, certainly, as Lee has pointed out, lobbying Washington is a multi-billion-dollar business, and that's just one area. If you add up every state, I'm sure it's more than that. But it's a cost benefit analysis. You know, one of the things that lobbyists provide is access. In a logistically difficult area, right? The process of Congress or the process of legislating laws is inherently confusing and difficult to understand. And what a lobbyist provides a corporation or an interest group or an association is a deep understanding of the logistics of how the world moves and how it shakes. And so you need to figure out from an internal standpoint how much money you're willing to spend on that alone, because that can make the difference. Accessing and just having general knowledge of how a bill becomes a law and the committee process. He mentioned the Cromnibus bill and the Citigroup stuff and how all that might work, which can be, of course, beneficial to a corporation. Just having general knowledge of the logistics of the process can glean a lot of money out of a corporation because it's so important.
Lee, can you give us an example maybe of just how much money might be spent on one specific bill in Washington by corporations that really, really want to influence lawmakers?
Well, at the upper bound, biggest individual companies are spending close to $20 million a year, and a lot of it depends on how ambitious this ask is. We have an example in Washington right now. Comcast was trying to merge with Time Warner Cable. They spent about $18 million a year. Now, not all of that is trying to convince Congress on why this merger should go forward, but a fair amount of that is. Now, truth is, they lost on that because they had a really bad case, but it was a really bad case to start with, and the fact that they thought that they could get it through just tells you how ambitious corporate lobbying has become.
Lee Drutman writes about this issue. He's a senior fellow at New America, and he's the author of The Business of America is Lobbying, How Corporations Became Politicized and Politics Became More Corporate. He joins us from Washington, D.C. today. Chris Vandehoof is here. He's director of government relations at Ticket Network. We're going to be joined by a Washington lobbyist coming up in a few moments. We'll take your calls as well at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with Lee Drutman, who's the author of a new book called The Business of America is Lobbying, How Corporations Became Politicized and Politics Became More Corporate. We're talking about the world of lobbying. We've brought in Chris Vandehoof, who's director of government relations at Ticket Network. He's also worked as a contract lobbyist here in Connecticut and elsewhere. I want to bring into the conversation as well Nicholas Allard, who's president and dean of Brooklyn Law School, and he's senior partner at Squire Patton Boggs. Nicholas Allard, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
I asked Chris Vandehoof this. I'd like to get your perspective. What is a lobbyist? What does a lobbyist do?
Well, I think Lee Drutman has it right. He's got a much broader definition. It's really anybody who's trying to have an impact on what the question of what should the law be, you know, what's the rule, and trying to influence the government in a broad sense. There's no magic, you know, and there's at least seven things a lobbyist does, and I can reel them off very quickly. One, it provides information to the government. That gets the most attention. Two, provides information to the client about how the government works and what it's supposed to do. Three, and this is the one the government doesn't like and the president doesn't like, but lobbyists hold the government accountable. Fourth, they hold their adversaries accountable, and they tell the government why the adversary's point of view is incorrect or not completely right. Fifth, lobbyists assure compliance. That's a little understood, but a lot of companies like compliance more than they like results. And sixth, they assure the compliance of their adversaries, you know, they rat out the others. And then seventh, and most important, in a time of deep institutional flaws, partisan gridlock, lobbyists navigate a path towards results and accommodation and consensus. So those are some of the things that lobbyists do, and I think that Lee has very ably described those things in his book.
I want to get to that one in the middle that you said the president and a lot of people don't like, the job of holding government accountable. I thought that was our job in the press here. How do lobbyists hold government accountable?
Well, the right to petition is in the First Amendment with the freedom of the press. So it is the journalist's point obligation, and it's their function. But also, the right to petition and the right to hire somebody to do it effectively is a very important function. And, you know, it's not particularly comfortable. The government doesn't particularly have to want to explain the basis for their decisions or to face, you know, adversaries.
I want to ask Lee Drutman, and if you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. I mean, the big headline, Lee Drutman, of your book is that there's so much money in lobbying that business has an outside influence in Washington. If that's indeed true, how do we change it? How do we get at some semblance of reform?
Well, I think there's two things, main things we can do. One, the most important, and we have already discussed it, is to increase the capacity of government to hire and retain top talent and enough of it to develop some real expertise, as well as building up independent research institutes of government like the GAO and CRS. Basically, make sure that Congress has the ability to understand these issues independently. At the same time, I think lobbyists provide many important functions, which Nicholas Allard described. Again, my concern is that most of that lobbying is representing corporations. Now, we've basically left advocacy to the market, and it's very easy for economic winners to reinvest their profits into Washington, and it's very hard for economic losers to do so. But I don't think we should let a market failure become a democratic failure, and I think we should think about some ways for the government to subsidize those perspectives that don't have the ability to hire their own lobbyists. I think no side has a monopoly on the truth, but public policy benefits when all sides have the resources and capacity to make their best case.
Chris, maybe
can I jump in?
Go ahead. Yeah,
Nick.
Yeah,
I think Lee has really got the tail of a very important issue, and that is. And he obviously was listening all those times he invited me in to teach his class. The problem is not corruption. I mean, that's the problem that people think about most. The problem is not that money buys results, because he's pointed out, you know, Comcast, Time Warner could not have spent more money, and they lost both on net neutrality and ability to get their merger through. And you can think of many other examples, you know, the AMA with health care reform or Wall Street with Dodd-Frank of not prevailing. He's got it right. And the real problem is asymmetry. Now, what to do about that? And it's a very interesting idea that he has, but for many people, I'm sure it's going to be hard to take. They're thinking if you give more resources to the government, you know, that only encouraged the you-know-what. You know, it's like throwing gas on a fire. It's a very interesting perspective. But how to address – he has a very sophisticated and mature objective, is that lobbying effectively is not inherently bad. There's just unevenness in the ability to have an impact. And so what do you do about that? And he has a very interesting solution. I think it's an incomplete solution, you know, without the biggest problem right now in ineffectiveness of people doing their jobs in Congress is how much time they have to spend raising money. And so Lee was not able to address campaign fundraising, and I understand why he did not in his book. But if you simply increase the resources available to Congress, you're going to increase their ability of them to rely more on staff and maybe spend more time on fundraising. And so it just escalates the arms race. So you really need to get a hold of that problem as well. I'm not disagreeing with his partial solution, but I wanted to give you that perspective.
But when you're saying that campaign finance reform, that a change to how much money politicians need to raise would be part of the solution, Nick, is that in part because it's just so pervasive and it spends so much time and that's where we're spending all of our money? Or is it that the direct access that people buy through campaign donations is actually more effective at getting at politicians than the type of softer influence that comes through lobbying?
Good question. I will be clear. I'll be very clear. The big scandal is not that politicians are corrupt. I worked with Abe Ribicoff. That was my first boss of Connecticut, and then Ted Kennedy and Senator Moynihan. And they taught me that politics is an honorable profession. The big scandal is not that money buys the results. The big scandal is that the members of Congress and legislators are everywhere are spending so much time raising money that they have little time and not enough time to deal with the massive increasing complexities of our modern life and to do their jobs. And we have to get at that problem. There's also a perception problem, obviously, but what you actually get for the campaign contributions is grossly overstated. I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to figure out a solution to this huge problem. So Lee's got his finger on an important issue, and that is that the Congress has been undergunned in being able to deal with the corporate America, you know, increase of volume and advocacy that affects them and then creates a noise which maybe shoves out other voices. That's a very important concept, but I don't think that addressing that alone is going to provide an effective solution.
Lee Drutman, a quick response?
I agree completely. My book focused on lobbying because there's been very little focus on lobbying, I think, but I agree with Nick Allard. I do think that you also want to do something about the financing of elections. It's not only that members of Congress waste incredible amounts of time spending hours on the phone, basically being telemarketers. I mean, that's the other big scandal, is that we're basically electing telemarketers to Congress. But also, as Senator Chris Murphy described it, I mean, you spend a lot of time, and he's given great remarks on this issue. You just spend a lot of time with these folks. If you're in Connecticut, you're spending time with the hedge fund folks, and you just have to make sure that you're acceptable to them. So that takes a number of issues off the table, and it takes a number of perspectives off the table. And frankly, if you're spending all this time with them, you start to be sympathetic to their view.
And Chris Vandehoof, you've worked very closely with Chris Murphy over the years, and I will say he sat in that chair where you're sitting right now when he was first elected to Congress, and he said to me, the thing that, you know, is more troubling than anything else is I started making phone calls right away. I mean, how much of a problem do you think that is? I mean, we're going down the road of campaign finance reform, but you know a lot about that world too, Chris.
Yeah, no, you know, both Nick and Lee hit this on the head, and especially in Congress. The Senate, you know, is 6-year terms. That's a little different. But in Congress, you know, these 2-year terms in a world where 24/7, you know, is not 24/7. Everything is happening right now in the time period that you have to think about the issue, to work on the issue, to work on fundraising, rebuilding a campaign, to run for re-election that's simply 2 years from the day that you get elected is no time at all. And so literally the next day, for many of these people who get elected, they're getting right back on the phone to start raising that money again. And, you know, and I want to just comment on something that Nick said, is this idea of corruption based on campaign finance, that lobbyists are writing checks and that's how everything gets done, is an absolute misnomer. And it just isn't. It is so drastically overstated that writing a check for $100 to a member of Congress, or even $250 or even $1,000, provides some sort of great access where you're sitting down writing long pieces of legislation for members of Congress. It's simply a product of the process because they only have time to fundraise.
I need to get to
that easy.
Go ahead.
If money bought results, the corporations wouldn't need lobbyists. All they have to do is write checks and just cut out the middleman. You know.
Yeah.
We wish it was that easy.
It would be a lot easier, a lot cheaper for them. Let's get to a few phone calls here quickly. Matt's in Farmington. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
Yes, I worked on Capitol Hill as a public interest lobbyist for 5.5 years, and I'm wondering if your guests can comment on the strength and power of constituent lobbying. I watched time and time again as people built relationships, not taking one-off actions, but actually building relationships, gained influence with offices, and even convinced unlikely suspects to vote differently.
Matt, it's a great point. And actually, Chris, we were just talking about that. Social media has changed things a lot. The direct access that you may have to someone like a Chris Murphy, well, you didn't used to be able to tweet your congressman or your senator, and now you actually can. But talk, if you would, a little bit more about what you've seen in terms of constituent lobbying from Matt's point of view.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And, you know, and as we were chatting about that, the access to social media, you know, Senator Murphy isn't the only one. There are numerous members of Congress on both sides of the aisle actively run their own Twitter feeds, their own Instagram feeds. They're even moving over now to Snapchat, and they've been on Facebook since the inception. And so it provides this instant access from a local level that that they, you know, and I firmly believe that 99.99% of all elected officials are there for the right reason. And so when a constituent reaches out to them via social media, that is a direct that is direct lobbying, frankly, from the constituent about something they're concerned about. And that member, of course, is going to listen to the constituent.
Lee Drutman is the
caller,
is. Well,
the
no, go ahead, Nick.
A wonderful question.
Yeah.
The caller had a wonderful question, and that the answer is that the public interest lobbies are often the most effective, and they don't have to start off with the initial challenge of overcoming, you know, some negativity or baggage that a corporate interest might have. And so that's number one. Number two is that the scales can tip in their side in that we're talking about the way lobbying is and was. But it's important to look ahead. And the face-to-face meeting has diminished in importance. The impacting and interacting with the government electronically has increased exponentially. And we haven't even talked about the other huge change, which is that lobbying now on many huge issues, financial reform and others, for example, are global, and it's not just in a simplistic way. It becomes a three- or four-dimensional chess game. So if you influence Bonn and London, Washington needs to follow in a rough parallel way. If you persuade Washington, then the others have to come along. So the complexity is escalating, but the impact of technology has empowered people in the street and public interest lobbyists and even up the score because there's less reliance on the limited access and the limited bandwidth, if you will, of members of Congress and their staff to take on face-to-face meetings.
So Lee Drutman?
Good news for the public interest.
Yeah, so I have 3 points on this subject that are a bit of cold water on this as the great equalizer. One is that the public only pays attention to a handful of issues. So there are some issues like the net neutrality, the SOPA-PIPA fight, where the public is deeply engaged, but it's a very small slice of the issues that Congress deals with. So there are certain issues on which the public can get engaged, and that makes a difference, but those are a very limited slice of issues. Second is that public comments, while they may be passionate and numerous, are often very ideological, very partisan, and not really dealing with the details. There's sort of a general diffuse sense that Congress should do something about this. They should punish the big banks. But when it comes down to actually figuring out how do you work out the details, public comments are not helpful at all. And third, and this is an increasingly a new phenomenon, is that corporations have figured out how to harness a lot of this public grassroots activity for their own ends. So you see a phenomenon of what sociologist Edward Walker has called grassroots for hire, where now a growing number of Fortune 500 companies are actually taking that grassroots social media energy and harnessing it for their own ends. So I'm a little bit a little bit uncertain whether this is a great equalizer. I don't think it will be.
We'll have to leave our conversation with that little dose of cold water from Lee Drutman. The book is called The Business of America is Lobbying, How Corporations Became Politicized and Politics Became More Corporate. He joined us from NPR in Washington, D.C. Lee, thank you so much. It was fascinating.
It's great to be with you, John.
Thanks also to Nicholas Allard, who's the president and dean of Brooklyn Law School, senior partner at Squire Patton Boggs, and also Chris Vandehoof, the director of government relations at Tick Network. Good to see you, Chris. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, John.
When we come back, Kevin Lembo, the state comptroller, is going to tell us how we're going to fix the state's rainy day fund, and it seems like it's raining all the time. This is where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, we're going to be working with the Colin McEnroe Show on a really interesting issue about how fast food and some of the soda drinks that are so popular but becoming less popular all the time, how this world is changing. We're talking about big changes in fast food into fast casual restaurants in the morning. And then Colin McEnroe Show is going to be talking a little bit about our soda wars. That's coming up on Monday's Where We Live. Hope you can join us. On Wednesday, the General Assembly's Finance Committee voted in favor of Senate Bill 1135. It's a piece of legislation proposed by the state comptroller to help stabilize Connecticut's rainy day fund. Here to talk about the state budget and this bill is Comptroller Kevin Lembo. Welcome back to Where We Live.
Good to see you, John.
Before we get into this specific piece of legislation, I guess the headline news today is once again yesterday we get new projections coming out of OPM, the governor's budget office, sent to you. We're still running a deficit in the state. Maybe you can explain exactly where we are with that right now, if you could.
Sure. They had to look at the revenue numbers that came in up to April 15th and a little bit after that and see if it was actually hitting the targets that they expected. As I think I'd been talking about for a number of months, it was highly unlikely that they were going to hit those targets. And so the governor's budget office has now adjusted their deficit number. And from their perspective, it looks worse than it did. And I put my number out later on today. So when I leave you, I'm headed back to the office and going to meet with a whole bunch of people who are way smarter than me to unpack the revenue picture and look at the economy generally.
And this is all very important because at the end of the day, Connecticut has to have a balanced budget, but we need to figure out whether or not we need to cut more state government. We need to make some maybe drastic, probably just minor adjustments right now. But then, of course, we're going to see more adjustments in the next couple years. For the everyday listener who doesn't follow the state budget every single day, Kevin Lembo, why does all this matter?
Well, it matters for the reasons that you've stated. We are required to have a balanced budget. The governor's budget office, the legislature's nonpartisan budget office, they have to come to agreement on consensus revenue numbers, and that is a good process. But the comptroller stands outside of that, and because I don't have a vote and I don't draft the budget, I don't have a dog in that fight. So my reporting on it is just based on the numbers as I see them, and we'll see where we are. It looks like at this point we are creeping up on the 1% threshold that requires the governor to convene the legislature to put together a mitigation plan. We are running out of time in the fiscal year. We've got about 60 days left, give or take. So even if they went in and did significant cuts into agencies, the likelihood that they would be able to realize the savings in time is questionable at this point.
Meaning convening the legislature to work out where the budget cuts are going to be as opposed to this, just the governor using a rescission authority and saying, here's places where I'm going to cut state government.
That's right. The governor has limited authority to go in and cut the budget. And once it hits that 1% threshold, he has to engage the legislature in that conversation, which is critical because then you bring the values and the interests and the ideas of a whole bunch of people to that conversation versus just one.
Yeah, and it could get pretty messy, I suppose. Well, this is bringing us to this bill that you've put forward, and it's got a lot of really interesting allies. And the reason this all this background about where we are in the budget fight is so important right now is essentially you're looking at changing the way we think about our state's rainy day fund, something that we've always kind of had. But I don't know, Ben Barnes, the governor's budget chief, said last year famously that we're in a state of permanent fiscal crisis. If this isn't a monsoon rainstorm, I don't know what is. So tell us, Kevin Lembo, how does the rainy day fund change under your plan?
Well, the rainy day fund, which is actually the budget reserve fund, we've been calling it the budget stabilization fund because it's a tool that we haven't really been using all these years. It was put in place to squirrel away resources in good economic times so we had money to bridge the next recession. And the next recession is obviously always coming. It's just a question of when. So we've been doing some work on this issue, looking at volatility in our tax code, in particular in the corporate tax and in the quarterly filer portion of the income tax, where you can see huge swings in revenue depending on the state of the financial markets. Historically, what Connecticut has done is budget up to, we'll call it the new reality of the moment, to reflect the new boom time, and then we cut and raise taxes as we head down into the hole. We have to get off the roller coaster for a number of reasons. One, it's grating on everybody's nerves, whether it's, you know, the guy in the gas station or the legislators at the Capitol. Everybody is tired of this. It erodes consumer confidence. It really sends a horrible message to businesses and to others that are thinking about coming or expanding here. And our intention really needs to be paid. So we put this proposal together. We worked about a year on modeling and running the models and trying to figure out sort of what would work best. And presented it to the Finance Committee. Senator Fonfara, Representative Berger, Senator France, the Republican ranking leader, and Representative Davis, the ranking House member, all had input into that, as well as leadership, rank and file. We built a consensus document built on those conversations. And as you say, it passed unanimously out of the Finance Committee earlier.
And how does it change what we're doing now? Can you explain specifically what this is going to do that we haven't been doing right all these years?
So right now what we do is wait till the end of the fiscal year, and if there's any money left, some of it may get transferred to the rainy day fund so it's there on deposit. It's like sitting at the dinner table and having, you know, the chicken bones laying there and everybody says there's a little bit more. Anybody want anything else? No, we're done. Okay, let's set it aside. it takes it from an afterthought, which is where it is now, up to the top of our thinking, in that those two volatile revenue streams would have 10-year average growth rates attached to them. We would look at the growth over 10 years and then put a cap, essentially, on what could be appropriated out of those two categories. Anything that comes in good economic times above that cap would get transferred immediately into the rainy day fund, or at least head that way. And at the end of the fiscal year, the balances would be significantly better than they are now. If we had done this a decade ago, we would have had sufficient resources to weather two recessions ago without incident, and even this last one that we're not fully out of, with only minor tweaks to the budget and certainly without a tax increase.
When do you dip into this rainy day fund? If indeed we'd have these 10 years of saving in the way that you've proposed here, and we had this reserve fund that was robust enough to help us get through this, how do we know when it's time to dip in? Because one of the things the governor's talked an awful lot about, for instance, recently, is whether or not we need to have a lockbox around a special transportation fund. Because there's certain funds that are supposed to be used in state government for certain things, but then when times get tough, we just go in there and we take the money anyway, and we figure somehow or other we'll get the transportation later. Well, now we're in a bunch of different crises around this. How do you know when it's okay for government to dip into the rainy day fund?
Right now, statutorily, there's a very specific process and time frame that the rainy day fund can be used. So there has to be a special vote. There has to be a certification of an emergency. There's a bunch of things that need to occur. When you look at Connecticut as compared to other states, and this is not my analysis, it's Pew Charitable Trust analysis, we actually get pretty good grades as a state in the mechanisms and the times that we pull money out of the rainy day fund. Where we get horrible grades is the process that we use to actually fill the rainy day fund in the first place. Now, that said, if we start squirreling away an appropriate level of reserve, it will become more and more attractive over time. And there's a couple of things you can do to try to put some sort of barriers around that fund. But most of them are already there. To go beyond where we are now, you would almost have to look at the Constitution or some other super, super majority process. And I'm not a big fan of sort of breaking open the Constitution every time we're concerned about future bad behavior of some elected official. You cannot protect against all that. The way we protect against that is to vote us out if we do things like that. So I think if the comptroller will report on this, the comptroller's office will report on this monthly, where are we? It will have to be included in the consensus revenue numbers. It will get public attention that we're building up our savings account for the next recession. I think it will make it less likely that it could be raided, at least without a public outcry.
I want to get back to this term volatility of the tax code and why that's such an important thing. It's something that whenever I talk about whether or not we need to have more tax revenue in the state, it's something I always come back to. Keith Faneth, the great budget reporter from the Connecticut Mirror, has talked a lot about this, that be careful what you wish for. If you say we need to tax the top income earners of the state at a higher level in order to make sure we balance the state budget, we have to understand that is an incredibly volatile source of funding, and we may think that the millionaires and billionaires are going to pay for us down the road, but we have a dip. All of a sudden, all that money goes away. Volatility is very important to look at.
It absolutely is. So as you point out, the more progressive your tax code, and that means simply that those who can afford to pay more, and those who can't pay less. The more progressivity you have, the more volatility generally that you're going to have. So, as an example, the withholding portion of the income tax, which most of us pay out of our paychecks, and then we settle up on April 15th. If you think of it as like a little wave, like on an EKG or an EEG, it's a little sort of slight wave that goes up and down, 3 to 5% above or below, manageable by most standards. The most volatile tax categories, corporate and quarterly filers of the income tax, can go 12, 15, 17% up and then fall down to zero and then go negative as much as 12% or more. So you're right. Be careful what you ask for. But the answer isn't necessarily to walk away from volatile tax categories. Yes. It's how do you manage the revenue when it comes in the door, not continue to budget up to the new reality, and make sure you've brought balance to the budget. Look, think about this. We are coming into legislative sessions year after year after year after year, good members, new members, older members, with ideas about ways to improve the public good. And they reach the door, and the first thing that they're faced with is, oh, we've got another budget crisis. Suddenly you chill any real public policy conversation at the Capitol, and people, all they hear is, I couldn't get that thing done. I had this important bill I was working on, and nothing's moving because, once again, we're in a budget crisis. The time to get off the roller coaster is now. It's going to necessitate some downward pressure on spending, tying our hands a little bit in good economic times. But it's going to level things out in the future, and we can shift the debate back to the important issues of the state.
Well, and one of the really interesting things about this proposal is that you gather together this sort of unlikely coalition. It's not often that you see some of the conservative groups and the liberal groups up at the state capitol all standing together and saying, you know what, this might be a good idea.
Right. We had a forum last Thursday where I sat with the head of the Pew Charitable Trust research arm. Together with us were Connecticut Voices for Children, arguably a left-of-center organization, and Yankee Institute, arguably a right-of-center organization. And the one thing we could all agree on is that this is the right thing to do now from many different perspectives. If you're interested in putting downward pressure on spending, this is the bill for you. If you're interested in bringing stability to funding to municipalities and to nonprofits over time, this is the bill for you. The members of the Finance Committee were very receptive. Senator Fonfara in particular has been amazing to work with on this. And I think it's got real legs. It's a bill in and of itself right now, still sitting there. It's moved to the calendar of the Senate. And it's also embedded into the finance package for the budget.
Does it have all the support that it needs?
Remains to be seen. You know, now we are in the negotiation portion of the budget. The legislature and the executive are going to have to get together and figure out, you know, where the edges are of their willingness to compromise. And my hope is that it will live through that. No one has spoken publicly against it at that point. Almost every editorial page in the state has weighed in favor of the proposal. So to be against it at this point, it's hard for me to find a rational reason to be against it, and it certainly would be counter everything else that's going on.
Do you think, aside from the support for this particular bill, do you think that there is a sense that things need to change at the state capitol about the way the work is being done? We've been hearing, as you said, for years and years and years, and I keep joking about the state of permanent fiscal crisis, but look, once we say that out loud, maybe Connecticut has to do something substantially different. Do you hear something that sounds like lawmakers and people in the executive branch saying, you know what, we've got to do something different? Even if it's not Kevin Lembo's plan, we've got to change the way we save for a rainy day and the way we actually account for the money that we bring in.
I think that the answer to that is absolutely yes. Whether it is a freshman legislator who walked in with something that they want to work on and wants to leave a mark on the building, they are interested in the bill. Those sophomore legislators or juniors who have lived through one boom and bust cycle, they too don't want to have to go back to their constituents and say that funding I got you 2 years ago for this important program now is getting cut in half or eliminated completely. We're going to have to raise taxes. They don't want to have to do that anymore unless it's absolutely necessary. And I think the general sentiment out in the world is that it's not absolutely necessary. And part of it is part of the reason we are where we are is a function of the way we run our house. And it's not been very good over the years, you know. So I think there's a path forward, and this is the one. And, you know, I tend not to overstate stuff, whether it's the fiscal matters or the impact of any specific bill. But I said to the Finance Committee as clearly as I could, I thought this bill, not because it was mine, not because it was partially theirs, could be one of the most important things they do from a budget perspective in their lifetime at the Capitol, in those jobs, in their careers.
We just have 30 seconds left. Has this worked in other states, or are we way out in front on this?
No, it has worked in other states. The model always has to be a little bit different to reflect the reality on the ground. But our neighbor to the north, Massachusetts, has done this with some success. Virginia is a great example. They put a program like this a number of years ago into place, and Moody's Investor Services, that does their bond rating, upgraded them to AAA bond status. So the other thing about it, John, real quick,
yeah,
is that
sure.
As the money is sort of moving to the rainy day fund, the plan is to grab a nickel on a dollar, 10 cents on a dollar on a, you know, a schedule, and start paying down unfunded liability as well. So when you do that, you start to chip away in a meaningful way about against that unfunded liability. You shrink its impact on the budget as a line item, and it shortens the time when we'll be free of that 20 years worth of loans folks have taken against the pension fund.
Kevin Lembo is the state comptroller. Thanks for bringing this out to us and for talking through this bill with us. I really appreciate your time.
Good to see you, John.
Our program produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan and Kyle Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. Our intern today is Kelsey Bissell. You can continue this conversation or our earlier conversation on our website, wnpr.org/where we live.